because this whole part of Chiapas where I am now is camps of Guatemalans. This whole livelong day, I drove horrible mountain roads in the rain and saw refugee camps, one after another, like a dream. They say the Guatemalan army is on a new scorched earth campaign, so people come running across the border with the clothes on their backs and their hearts in their throats, and on a good day, the Mexican cops don't bother them. On a bad day, they make them wake up the kids, take down their hammocks, and move into somebody else's district. It's a collective death. A whole land-based culture is being relocated out of its land, like a body trying to move out of its skin. Only the portable things survive. The women have their backstrap looms and woven clothes, like you see sometimes in import stores. All those brilliant colors in this hopeless place, it kills you. Right this minute, I'm sitting in the rain, waiting for the mail truck / water delivery. I keep expecting that same guy with his Fanta truck. And watching four barefoot kids around a cook fire. The one in charge is maybe six. She's sharpening cooking sticks while these damp black chickens strut around shaking themselves. And the toddlers pull logs out and roll them to make sparks. I'm just on edge. You live your life in the States and you can't even picture something like this. It's easy to get used to the privilege of a safe life. I know you're worrying, but you don't have to, since we've established that I'm the luckiest person alive, even though I don't feel like it. I'll write from Nika next. I'm sure I'll be happier once I'm put to some use. I miss you, Cody. Write and make me feel better. Love from your faithful, adoring slave for life, Hallie. The ending was an old joke. In our letters, we used to try to outdo each other with ingratiating closures. The rest of the letter was pure Hallie. Even in a lethargic mood, she noticed every vanilla orchid, every agony and ecstasy, especially agony. She might as well not have had skin where emotions were concerned. Other people's hurt ran right over into her flesh. For example, I'll flip through a newspaper and take note of the various disasters, and then Hallie will read the same paper and cry her eyes out. She'll feel like she has to do something about it. And me, if I want to do anything, it's to run hell for leather in the other direction. Maybe it's true what they say, that as long as you're nursing your own pain, whatever it is, you'll turn your back on others in the same boat. You'll want to believe the fix they're in is their own damn fault. The strangest thing is that where pain seemed to have anesthetized me, it gave Hallie extra nerve endings. This haunts me. What we suffered in our lives, we went through together. But somehow we came out different doors on different ground levels. Friday night after the first week of school, the dog with the green bandana showed up again at the gate. I saw it when I came outside after my solitary supper to water the morning glories and potted geraniums on my front step. The heat seemed to wilt them right down to death's door, but water always brought them back. I can only wish for such resilience. "Hi, buddy," I said to the dog. "No barbecues today. You're out of luck." 30 seconds later, Lloyd was standing at the door with a bottle of beer. "I told you I'd get back to you with this," he said, grinning. "I'm a man of my word." "Well, okay," I said. "I guess you are." I wasn't sure how I felt about seeing him in my doorway, other than surprised. I pulled a couple of folding chairs onto the patio where we could see the sunset. The sky was a bright, artificial-looking orange, a color you might expect to see in the Hollywood shop. "Are you going to have one too, or do I drink this alone?" I asked him. Lloyd said he'd just take a soda because he was marked up and 5 times out. I was mystified by this information. "I'm marked up on the call board at the depot," he explained, "to take a train out. 5 times out means I'm 5th in line. I'll probably get called late tonight or early tomorrow morning." "Oh," I said. It sounded like baseball scores. The count is 3 and 2 and it's the bottom of the 7th. Lloyd laughed. I guess it would sound like that. You get used to talking railroad talk like it was plain English. Around here, that's about all everybody does is railroad. That and watch the fruit fall off their trees. Lloyd looked at me, surprised. You know about that, do you? Not very much, I said. I went into my house to get him a soda, picking my way over the rough bricks of the patio because I was barefoot. I will say this much for Doc Homer's career as a father. My arches are faultless. When I came back out, I sat down and handed over a Coke, letting Lloyd fight with the easy-off twist cap himself. I had to use pliers on those things. It didn't give Lloyd 2 seconds of trouble. He palmed it, then tipped his head back and drank about half the bottle. The things that aggravate me most in the world are the things men do without even knowing it. So is that your dog? I asked. That's Jack. You met? Jack, this lady here is Cody Nolene. We've met, I said. I sneaked him some goat spare ribs the other day at the fiesta. I hope he's not on a special diet or anything. He's in love is what he is if you gave him a piece of that goat. That was one of Angel Pilar's yearling billy goats. Jack's had his eye on those spare ribs ever since last summer. Jack looked at me, panting seriously. His tongue was purplish, and his eyes were very dark brown and lively. Sometimes when you look into an animal's eyes, you see nothing, no sign of connection, just the flat stare of a wild creature. But Jack's eyes spoke worlds. I liked him. He looks like a coyote, I said. He is. Half. I'll tell you the story of his life sometime. I can't wait, I said, really meaning it, though it came out sounding a little sarcastic. Our chairs were close enough together so that I could have reached over and squeezed Lloyd's hand, but I didn't do that. It was nice of you to come by, I said. So this was your first week of school, right? How's life with the juvenile delinquents of Grace? I was a little bit flattered that he knew about my job, but then everybody would. I don't know, I said. Pretty scary, I think. I'll keep you posted. The sky had faded from orange to pale pink, and the courtyard was dusky under the fig trees. Every night as it got dark, the vegetation around the house seemed to draw itself in closer, hugging the whitewashed walls, growing dense as a jungle. Lloyd touched my forearm lightly and pointed. On the cliff above the courtyard wall, a pair of coyotes trotted along a narrow animal path. Jack's ears stood up and rotated like tracking dishes as we watched them pass. You know what the Navajo call coyotes? God's dogs, Lloyd said. His fingers were still resting on my forearm. Why is that? I asked. He took his hand back and cracked his knuckles behind his head. He leaned back in his chair, stretching his legs. I don't know. I guess because they run around burying bones in God's backyard. Jack got up and went to the courtyard wall. He stood as still as a rock fence except for one back leg, which trembled, betraying all the contained force of whatever it was he wanted to do just then but couldn't. After a minute, he came back to Lloyd's feet, turned his body in a tight circle 2 or 3 times, and lay down with a soft moan. Why do they do that? Turn in circles like that, I asked. I'd never lived with a dog and was slightly infatuated with Jack. Beating down the tall grass to make a nice little nest, Lloyd said, even if there's no tall grass. Well, I guess that makes sense from a dog's point of view. Sure it does. He bent forward to scratch Jack between the ears. We take these good, smart animals and put them in a house and then wonder why they keep on doing the stuff that made them happy for 1 million years. A dog can't think that much about what he's doing. He just does what feels right. We were both quiet for a while. How do you know what the Navajos call coyotes? I thought you were Apache. I felt vaguely that it might be racist to discuss Lloyd's breeding, but he didn't seem offended. I'm a lot of stuff, he said. I'm a mongrel, like Jack. I was born up in Santa Rosalia Pueblo. My mama still lives up there. You ever been up there to Pueblo country?
No, I said.
It's pretty country. You ought to go sometime. I lived up there when I was a little kid. Me and my brother, Leander. God, we ran wild all over that place.
You have a brother? I never knew that.
Twin, Lloyd said. He's dead.
Everybody's got a secret, I thought.
And for the first time that evening, I remembered the child of Lloyd's that was unknown to him. It felt furtive and strange to hold it in mind in his presence, as if I were truly holding it and he might see it. A dust-colored peafowl hopped onto the courtyard wall and then into the fig, rustling the leaves and warning us off with a throaty chirruping sound. She was awkward and heavy-bodied, no more flight-worthy than a helicopter. So you're Pueblo and Apache and Navajo, I said.
My dad's Apache. We boys left Mama and came down to White Mountain to live with him, but it didn't work out. I ended up in Grace with my Mama's sister. You knew my tia Sonia, right?
I don't think so. Is she still around?
No, she's gone back to Santa Rosalia. I need to go up there and see her and Mama one of these days.
It sounded like a strangely scattered family. I still wasn't clear on the Navajo connection.
Can I use your phone? He asked suddenly.
Sure, it might be in use. It's Emelina's and JT's phone. They just ran an extension out for me. He looked toward the main house as he ducked into my front door. Emelina and JT were both home tonight, and Lloyd seemed a little guilty about not going over to say hello. It would have been easy for him to come by on the pretense of visiting them, but he hadn't. I wondered if Lloyd still had a reputation as a ladies' man. Though it was nothing to me, one way or the other. Jack raised his head and peered at me through the darkness, then got up and moved slightly closer to me. I stretched my leg and rubbed his back with my bare foot. His coat was a strange blend of textures, wiry on top and soft, almost downy underneath. Hallie and I almost had a dog once, back when our Tucson house was on the Underground Railroad. Hallie had come home one night with a refugee woman and a child and a little cinnamon dog. The mother had been tortured, and her eyes offered out that flatness, like a zoo animal. But I remember the girl, in a short pink dress and corduroy pants, following that puppy under the bathroom sink and all over the house. I had no reason to believe, now, that any of the three was still living. The woman and her daughter were eventually arrested and sent back to tropical, lethal San Salvador. And we'd decided, realistically, that we didn't have room for a dog. So it went to the Humane Society. Terms like that, Humane Society, are devised with people like me in mind, who don't care to dwell on what happens to the innocent. Lloyd came back out, being careful not to slam the decrepit screen door.
I'm next in line, he said. Three guys ahead of me laid off to watch the Padres game. I better get home.
Jack got up instantly and went to his side. Well, thanks, I said, still thinking of the cinnamon dog. I held up my bottle. It's nice to see you again, Lloyd. He stood there grinning, the fingers of his right hand playing with Jack's nape. I didn't know quite how to finish off the evening. Lloyd hesitated and then said, I've got to drive up to White River a week from Saturday to see about something.
Well, that sounds mysterious, I said.
To see about some game birds. Anyway, I thought you might like to get out of here for some fresh air. You want to go?
I took a deep breath.
Sure, I said. I wasn't sure at all, but my mind had apparently made itself up.
Okay, I could use some fresh air. Lloyd gave a funny little nod and went out through the gate. Jack disappeared behind him into the cactus jungle.
Homero. Chapter 10. The Mask. He is lying on his own examining table, resting his eyes. The telephone buzzes quietly, but Mrs. Quintana, his receptionist, has given up the battle with insurance forms and gone home. He places his long hands over his face, the fingertips lightly touching his forehead, thumbs
resting on the maxillary bones beneath his eyes. His office in the hospital basement is cool even in this late September heat, and pleasant in winter as well, as practical and comforting as a cave. The lack of windows has never been a problem. Artificial lighting is adequate. He has just examined his last patient of the day, a 16-year-old with six small gold rings piercing the cartilage of her left ear. She is expecting twins. They will be born small and in trouble. There was no reason to tell her everything. He imagines the procedure by which the tiny gold wires were inserted through flesh and spongy bone. It would have to be painful. He is mystified. Children devote slavish attention to these things, but can't be bothered with prophylactics. He drifts between wakefulness and sleep, thinking of Cody. Her eyes are downturned and secretive, her heart clearly hardened against him already to have done this. Her hair is in her eyes. She flips it sideways, chewing the inside of her lip and looking out the window when he talks to her. She'd wanted pierced ears at 13. He'd explained that self-mutilation was preposterous and archaic. Now they discuss shoes. He wants to ask, "Do you know what you have inside you? Does your sister know?" Hallie is young to understand reproductive matters, but it's impossible that she wouldn't know. There's so much of a single mind, and he is outside of it completely. He has no idea what he can say. She's in the fifth or sixth month from the look of her, although Cody was always too thin and now is dangerously thin and so skillful at disguising it with her clothes, he can only tell by other signs. The deepened pigmentation under her eyes and across the bridge of her nose, for one thing, is identical to the mask of pregnancy Alice wore both times, first with Cody, then with Hallie. It stuns him. He feels a sharp pain in his spleen when he looks across the breakfast table each morning and sees this, his wife's face. The ghost of their happiest time returned to inhabit the miserable body of their child. He can't help feeling he has damaged them all just by linking them together. His family is a web of women, dead and alive, with himself at the center like a spider, driven by different instincts. He lies mute, hearing only in the tactile way that a spider hears, touching the threads of the web with long extended fingertips and listening, listening for trapped life. Cosima. Chapter 11. A River on the Moon. Lloyd and I didn't go to White River. He was called out on Friday for a 7-day stand on a switch engine in Lordsburg. He seemed disappointed and promised we'd go another time. Lloyd didn't have much seniority on the railroad. He'd only moved back to Grace a few years earlier, and at Southern Pacific, he was still getting what he called bumped a lot. It was hard to plan his time off. I was somewhat relieved. I'd been unsure of what I was getting into and had my doubts. Once I found out, I had more. I'd asked JT what game birds were. He and I were out working in the old plum orchard one evening, pruning dead branches out of the trees. My job was mainly to stay out of the way of falling timber. It was a fair distance from the house, and Emelina had asked if I could go along to keep an eye on him. She wasn't the type to worry, but a man hanging from the treetops wielding a chainsaw is a nerve-wracking sight, believe me, even if he isn't your husband. JT informed me that game birds were fighting cocks. He was taking a break just then, leaning on one hand against a tree trunk and drinking what seemed like gallons of water. I was stunned. "You mean like cockfights?" JT smiled. "You been talking to Lloyd?" "He invited me to go with him up to White River. He said something about game birds," and I laughed at myself. "I don't know. I was thinking of something you'd eat, Cornish hens." He laughed, too.
He offered me the jar of water, and I drank from it before handing it back. I was surprised at the easy intimacy I felt with JT. We hadn't been friends in high school. He was, after all, captain of the football team. Through no meanness on his part, but simply because of the natural laws of adolescent segregation, we might as well have gone to high school on different planets. Being neighbors again now brought back what we'd forgotten then. We had a relationship that dated back even before Emelina. We were next-door neighbors in toddlerhood. We'd played together before male and female had meaning. He turned up the glass jar and drank it to the bottom, tensing the muscles in his jaw when he swallowed. JT's whole body shone with sweat. I briefly imagined him naked, which disturbed me. I'd slept with someone's husband before, an Asian history professor in college, mistaking his marital status for something comforting and fatherly. But I was devoted to Emelina. No, that wouldn't happen. It was early October and still hot. Grace was supposed to have the perfect climate like Camelot or Hawaii, and it's true that growing up here I could hardly remember an uncomfortable day, temperature-wise. Most of the homes had neither air conditioning nor central heating and didn't need them, but this fall had turned into hell warmed over. Down in the desert, in Tucson, every day was in the 110s, and though TV weathermen were reporting the string of broken records almost proudly, like scores in a new sport. In Grace, no one kept track especially, but we suffered just the same. JT knelt down to start the chainsaw again, but I spoke up before he could yank the cord. I thought cockfighting was illegal. Most everywhere it is, but not in the state of Arizona. And up on the reservation, they got their own laws. Loy's not a criminal, if that's what you're asking. I guess I don't know what I'm asking. I just can't see Lloyd and cockfighting. His daddy was real big in the sport. He was kind of a legend up there in Apache country. So Lloyd's got to keep up the tradition, I said, without sympathy. I knew Lloyd's father was also a renowned drunk. JT asked, "You an animal lover?" "Not to extremes," I said. "I eat them." I thought of how unmoved I'd been watching Emelina chop off heads for our Sunday dinner that first day in Grace. "But watching animals kill each other for sport," I said tentatively, "that's kind of an unsavory business, isn't it?" I looked toward the edge of the orchard. It was getting dark fast. Already I could see moonlight reflected in the irrigation ditches. JT sat on his heels and looked straight up into the branches over our heads. "I don't know why I mess with these trees," he said. "They're 60 years old. They don't produce worth a damn anymore. I could cut them down and get a lot better out of this ground, not to mention the firewood. But my daddy gave me this orchard." He picked up the stone of a plum, weathered shiny white like a tooth, and rubbed it with his thumb. After a minute, he raised his arm with a quick overhand snap and threw it toward the river. Lloyd's old man didn't have one damn thing to give him but cockfighting. JT looked up at me. "I'm not crazy about it either, Cody, but you got to know Lloyd before you decide." I dropped the subject of cockfighting. Lloyd had begun to come by fairly regularly in the evenings, which is to say regular for a railroad man. I'd see him 3 days in a row, and then not at all for a week. It reinforced the feeling that we were only casual acquaintances, meeting nearly by accident, and I tried to limit my expectations to the point where I paid no attention to how I looked in the evenings. Sometimes, as I walked around the brick floors of my living room and bedroom, I'd realize I was listening for the jingle of Jack's tags, and then I'd click on the radio. When Lloyd did show up, we would drag our lawn chairs out for a view of the sun's parting shot at the canyon wall, and we'd talk about nothing in particular. For instance, he told me the story of Jack's life. Jack's mother was a coyote that Lloyd took in when he was living up on the Apache reservation. She'd been crippled with buckshot in her shoulder and had gone into heat. Lloyd saw her one night skirting the arroyo behind his house, trying to get away from a pack of males. He got her attention with a low whistle, and then he left his front door open and went to bed,
Next morning, she was curled up under his cot. I didn't question this. For one thing, he seemed to hold a power over females of all types. But truly, Lloyd had the most unself-conscious way of telling a story I'd ever heard. As if it didn't matter whether I was impressed or not, he was just going to give me the facts. It seemed as if he didn't care enough one way or the other to lie. I kept her shut up in the house for a week with my dad's old dog Gunner. Gunner lost one of his back legs when he was a pup, and he could get around real good, but he'd never in his life mounted a female. I thought she'd be safe with him. This matter-of-fact talk about heat and mounting made me slightly edgy, or rather, edgy once removed. I felt like I ought to be uneasy with Lloyd, but I wasn't. To him, it was life and death and dogs. Sometimes Lloyd seemed about 12. "Well, Jack is here to tell the tale," I said, "so I guess she wasn't safe." Lloyd smiled. "Nope. Old Gunner had his one chance at love. He got into some poison coyote bait right after that. He died before the pups were born." "How do you know they were his? She could have been pregnant already." Lloyd asked Jack, as politely as you'd ask a favor from a friend, to roll over. "See that?" Over Jack's heart was a white patch with a black crescent moon in its center. "That's Gunner's. There were 7 pups, 2 black, 5 brown, and every one of them had that badge." "How did you know which one to keep?" He hesitated. "Dad decided," he said finally, "and Jack." "Really, I guess Jack's the one that decided." They were nothing electrifying, these chats with Lloyd in the dark, but they were a relief from my days at the high school, which were spent in a standoff just shy of open war. Occasionally, Lloyd took the tips of my fingers and rubbed them absent-mindedly between his own, the way he would surely stroke Jack if Jack had fingers. The night of the story of Jack, he also kissed me before he left, and I was surprised by how I responded. Kissing Lloyd was delicious, like some drug I wanted more of in spite of the Surgeon General's warning. Later on, when I slept, I had dreams of coyotes in heat. I also saw Hallie. Her hair moved around her like something alive. "I've kissed a man who kills birds," I confessed, but she looked past me as if she didn't have a sister. Her eyes were pale as marbles. I woke up confused, too shaken to get up and turn on a light. I dreamt of Carlo, too, on several occasions, for no good reason I could see. He'd written me a letter that was fairly medical and devoid of passion. He did miss me, though, and that sentiment brought comfort as I lay in my empty bed. It meant I was lonely by choice, or by difficult circumstances such as an ailing father. These things are supposed to feel better than being lonely because nobody wants you. Lately, I'd started thinking about Carlo with a kind of romantic wistfulness, which I knew was bogus. The truth is, we'd essentially promised each other from the beginning that we wouldn't stay together. "No strings," we said, proving that we were mature medical students without spare time. The odd thing is that we did stay together, physically. And so I suppose falling out of love was our heart's way of keeping the bargain. The end was always curled up there between us, like a sleeping cat, present even in our lovemaking. Especially there. Carlo and I had gone to bed together for the first time one early dawn during our rotation in pediatric intensive care, after we'd worked all night trying to save a Papago baby brought in too late from the reservation. We'd gone straight from the dead baby to my apartment, my bed. There was hardly any talk that I remembered. We just held on to each other, joined, for as long as our bodies could stand it. I wanted anything that would stop that pain, and Carlo was strong medicine. Not happiness, nothing joyful, only medicine. There was one other time of desperate, feverish connection that I particularly remembered. This was much later when Carlo and I were living abroad. Carlo had been granted the opportunity to spend a year in an unbelievably remote clinic halfway up the tallest mountain in central Crete.
The work was rugged, but in December we took a trip away from the village to Venice. The clinic closed for some combination of clan ritual and Greek Orthodox holiday that practically evacuated the village. We set off for Italy, feeling like truant school kids, drinking wine in tin cups on the train and reeling with the heady sense of getting away with something. Before that, he'd scarcely managed an afternoon off, much less a week. Then Carlo came down with a cold on the overnight ferry to Brindisi, and by the time we reached Venice, we were both burning up, our skin hot to the touch like furnaces. Our body's internal combustion gave rise to an unquenchable craving for carbohydrates and for each other. So we checked into the Pensione Meraviglioso and for a week ate plates of pasta and made a kind of sweaty, delirious love, previously unknown to either of us, in a bed that was memorably soft and huge. The pensione looked out onto the cold, damp Grand Canal and a dim little plaza ominously named the Piazza of the Distraught Widows. Distraught or inconvenienced, it could translate either way. The origin of this name was unknown to the elderly matron who was born and raised in the building. She brought food up to us and was alternately scandalized by our appetites and worried for our well-being. She was of the opinion that in damp weather any illness at all would find its way into the lungs. She ventured to tell us we ought to see a doctor. Carlo spoke Italian. His father had come to America on a steamer carrying cured leather and Chianti. He explained in grammatically imperfect but polite terms that we were both doctors. We could not be in better hands, he said. For my benefit, later he'd translated the double entendre. By the end of the week, Carlo and the matron were bosom friends. In spite of his notorious shyness, whenever she brought us hot tea, he would sit up in bed with a shirt on and give opinions on the infertility of her eldest daughter and the lung ailment of her son-in-law who worked in the glass-blowing trade. I lay beside him, meanwhile, with the sheets pulled around my neck, feeling sinful and out of place, like a whore taken home to meet mother. The matron didn't ask for my opinions, probably because she didn't believe I was actually a doctor. Which I wasn't, technically. I did some work at the clinic. Rural Crete was not overly concerned about licensure. But to be completely honest, I was Carlo's paramour. I did the shopping. I learned the Greek words for oil and soap and bread. I know that a woman's ambitions aren't supposed to fall and rise and veer off course this way, like some poor bird caught in a storm. All I can say is, at one of the many junctures in my life when I had to sink or swim, Crete was an island, a place to head for, new and far away. I had just dropped out of medicine in my first year of residency, a few months shy of becoming a licensed MD. I'd discovered there was something serious, mainly a matter of nerve and perhaps empathy, that stood in my way. I learned all this while a baby was trying to be born feet first. I couldn't think how I was going to tell Doc Homer, and I'll admit I was attracted just then to the idea of putting an ocean between myself and that obelisk of disapproval. It also helped that Carlo really wanted me to go with him. But I had no mission beyond personal survival. It was nothing like Hallie's going to Nicaragua. Our village had its own kind of bleakness, the bones and stones of poverty, but the landscape was breathtaking. Our classmates were treating intestinal parasites in Niger and Haiti, black lung in Appalachia, while Carlo and I set broken legs on the steep slope of Mount Ida, mythical birthplace of Zeus. Poverty in a beautiful place seemed not so much oppressive as sublime. Basically, it's the stuff of the world's great religions, I told myself, although I knew better. It was 100 degrees in the shade, and the burgeoning minds of Biology 1 and 2 took a field trip to the river. Our putative goal was to get some samples of water to examine under the microscope. We were learning about the plant and animal kingdoms, starting right down at the bottom of the ladder with the protozoans and the blue-green algae.
I could easily have collected a gallon of river water myself and brought it in, but the school had no air conditioning, and I'm not completely without a heart. I'd played it tough with the kids long enough to prove my point, if there was one, and I was tired of it. We all were. I knew the trip to the river would turn into a party. I didn't try too hard to go against nature. The tall kid with the skinhead haircut, whose name was Ramo, was the first one to get wet up to his t-shirt. It took about 90 seconds. I only drew the line when the boys started throwing in girls against their will. "Okay, knock it off, scientists. Marta says she doesn't want to get wet," I said. Marta shot me a lipstick-red pout when they put her down, but she'd shrieked no, and I felt there was a lesson to be learned here all the way around. "I got a ton of sample bottles here, so let's get going." I sat a safe distance up the riverbank under an ash tree, labeling full bottles as they were brought to me. I'd suggested that they collect shallow and deep water, moving and stagnant, but they went far beyond this, collecting anything that moved. It was enough to make you believe in the hunting instinct. There was a low, grassy island in the middle of the riffle, and several kids were out there on their knees catching bugs and frogs. Ramo actually caught a 6-inch perch with a net fashioned from his t-shirt. "Sooner or later, I figure we'll get around to fish," he said. "A fish is an animal, right?" "Right," I said, and let him dump it, along with the frogs, into a mop bucket we'd cajoled from the janitor. I don't know what teaching in a big city school is like, but at Grace High, we were flexible about interdepartmental appropriations. Back in the lab, we rounded up all the creatures visible to the naked eye and made a home for them in an aquarium that had once held blue and orange ping pong balls used for some mystical experiment in physics. Marta and two other cheerleaders disposed of the ping pong balls and took over the terrarium project. They made a pond on one side for the fish and an admirable mossy island on the other side, complete with a beach and a cave they called the Motel Frog. They refused to deal directly with the clients, though. Ramo transferred the fish and frogs with his bare hands from the mop bucket. The next day, we got out the microscopes. The kids groaned, preferring to do experiments on the frogs. It's hard to get people interested in animals that have no discernible heads, tails, fins, or the like. And plants? Forget it. There's no drama. You just don't have the skulking and stalking and gobbling up of innocent prey in the plant world. They don't even eat, except in the most passive sense. In college, I knew a botany professor who always went around saying, "It takes a superior mind to appreciate a plant." Hallie and I were a case in point, I guess. We divided the world in half right from childhood. I was the one who went in for the instant gratification, catching bright, quick butterflies, chloroforming them in a mason jar, and pinning them onto typewritten tags with their Latin names. Hallie's tastes were quieter. She had time to watch things grow. She transplanted wildflowers and showed an aptitude for gardening. At age 10, she took over the responsibility of the burpees catalog. But now I was on my own in the Garden of Eden. I was expected to teach the entire living world to these kids. I would write Hallie and ask her advice on how to turn adolescents on to organisms that have no appreciable sex life. In the meantime, we were doing protozoans, which I could handle. I drew huge, fantastic pictures in colored chalk of what we could expect to see in this river water. Strands of nostoc, like strings of blue pearls. Multi-tentacled hydras, rotifers barreling into each other like hyperactive kids. I demonstrated the correct way to put a drop of water on the glass slide, cover slip it, and focus the scope. The lab grew quiet with concentration. They couldn't see anything. At first I was irritated, but bit my tongue and focused a scope myself, prepared to see the teeming microscopic world of a dirty river. I found they were right. There was nothing. It gave me a strange panic to see that stillness under powerful magnification. Our water was dead. It might as well have come from a river on the moon. For homework, I assigned my classes the task of being spies. They were to find out from their parents what the hell was going on with this river. The pH, which we tested, from some areas came in just a hair higher than battery acid. I couldn't believe the poisoning from the mine had gone this far. Protozoans are the early warning system in the life of a river, like a canary in a mine. And this canary was dead. We took a closer look at Ramo's perch, named Mr. Badfish, and the frogs in the terrarium, which seemed in reasonably good health, but then they'd been awfully easy to catch. It can't be legal, I lamented to Viola, as we sat on the front porch with three of the boys and four grocery bags of snap beans. Emelina and John Tucker were in the kitchen canning as fast as we could snap. When it came to childbearing and gardening, Emelina seemed unable to walk the path of moderation. It's not legal, Viola said grumpily. What difference does it make? We worked in silence for a while. The aluminum bowl between us rang like a bell when we threw our hard green beans against its sides. Mason hadn't managed to master the art of snap beans and had fallen asleep in the glider. The twins elbowed each other like irritable birds on a wire. Viola had been overseeing the boys in the garden most of the morning and for once seemed tired. She was wearing lavender stretch pants, an embroidered blouse, and a baseball cap with the insignia of the Steelworkers Union. JT's father had worked in the smelter for 40 years, from age 18 until he died of lung cancer. The cap sat forward on Viola's head because her long hair was pinned in a thick circle at the back. According to Emelina, Viola felt the boys were losing touch with their past, but looking at her now, I couldn't get a fix on what that past might be. I thought of the Elvis whiskey bottle collection up in her room. I didn't really know Viola the way I knew Emelina and JT and the kids. She was always skirting around the edges of rooms with her hands full, just ready to go somewhere, too busy to sit down and talk. They'll have to pay a fine if they don't stop polluting the river, I said cheerfully. The EPA will shut them down if they don't clean it up. At Emelina's urging, I'd gone down to the courthouse and filed an affidavit with local authorities on the pH and biotic death of the river. I used the most scientific language I could muster, such as biotic death and oxygen load. I'd written Hallie about it. Viola said without looking up, "They're just going to divert the river." "What?" She bent over with a soft groan and took another double handful of beans out of the grocery bag between her legs and set them into her apron. Curtis and Glenn had stopped hitting each other for the moment and were having a race. It took them forever to snap any beans because they had to stop every 2 minutes to count who had done the most. "Dam up the river," Viola said. "That's all they have to do to meet with the EPA loss. Dam it up and send it out Tortoise Canyon instead of down through here. The EPA just says they can't put it down here where people live." "But then there would be no water for the orchards. That would be worse than the way it is now." "That's right, but it's okie-dokie with the EPA. The men all had a town meeting about it yesterday with this hotshot guy from Phoenix. They sat and talked for about 9 or 10 hours, and finally what he told them is if Black Mountain dams up the river, it's out of the jurisdiction of the Environmental Protection Agency." Viola reeled out the long words scornfully as if she were glad to get them out of her mouth. "That's impossible," I said. "There are water rights." "Nobody around here's got water rights. All these families sold the water rights to the company in 1939 for 25 cents an acre. We all thought we were getting money for nothing. We had us a fiesta." I stared at her. "So do you know for sure that's what they're going to do? Divert the river?" She shrugged. "Who knows what anybody is going to do for sure? We could all die tomorrow. Only the Lord knows." I wanted to shake her. I wish she would look me in the eye. "But this is what you've heard is going to happen?" She nodded once, never taking her eyes off the snap beans that flew through her hands and rang freshly broken into the aluminum bowl. I still couldn't believe it. "How could they do that?"
"With bulldozers," Viola said.
Lloyd and I made another date for White River, this time on a Sunday in October. The evening before, I went with Emelina to hear chicken scratch music at the outdoor restaurant run by Doña Altea's four daughters. The same traveling Wyla bands had been coming over from the Papago Reservation for decades, substituting sons for fathers so gradually that the music never changed. Emelina's normal taste ran to country, Merle Haggard and Dolly Parton, but Wyla was something special, she said. She was crazy about it. Her boys, enlightened by MTV, rolled their eyes. She took Mason and the baby with us because, as Emelina put it, they were too little to have a choice. The restaurant was outdoors, in a walled courtyard that was a larger, more Baroque version of Emelina's. Flowers bloomed everywhere out of pots shaped like pigs and squatty roosters, some of which had lost body parts, and two enormous old olive trees sparkled with tiny Christmas lights that evidently knew no season. Carved out here and there in the thick adobe wall were rounded niches that were home to weather-worn saints the size of a G.I. Joe. Some, in fact, looked suspiciously like dolls in saints' clothing. In a corner, near where the band was setting up, stood a 4-foot-tall, almost comically thin St. Francis of Assisi. He looked venerable and tired, also hungry, and was surrounded by a postmodern assortment of glazed ceramic and plastic birds. The tables and chairs were of every imaginable type, following the same theme, and the flatware, too, like snowflakes, no two alike. The effect was completely festive, in spite of Doña Altea's daughters. All four of them, who each had Altea lodged somewhere in her name, were over 60, as thin as St. Francis, but without his animal magnetism. They moved through the crowd with efficient scowls, taking orders and bringing out heavenly food from the little kitchen, all the while acting as though they couldn't quite understand why they'd agreed to go to all this trouble. You would think they'd have figured it out by now. It had been the most popular restaurant in town for half a century. With tender paternal attention, the Alvaro brothers unwrapped their musical instruments, which traveled in comfort, nestled in bright-blocked quilts. The men appeared to be three generations rather than actual brothers. The elder Alvaro, dressed in cowboy boots and a formal Western shirt, cradled a gunmetal saxophone that reminded me of World War II planes. A middle-aged Alvaro with shoulder-length hair played accordion, and two boys in T-shirts played bass guitar and drums. The old sax player stepped up to the microphone. "We are the Alvaro brothers," he said. "If we make too much noise, let us know." It was the last time any of them smiled. From the instant they began to play, they stood motionless with their mouths turned down in concentration. Everybody else was dancing in their seats. Chicken scratch music is Mexican-spiced Native American polka. It sounds like a wild, very happy, and slightly drunken wedding party, and it moves you up and down. You can't keep still. A line of older women in dark skirts and blouses, possibly Alvaro sisters or Alvaro wives, stood near the kitchen, swaying a little and tapping their feet. Several couples began to dance, and I could tell Emelina was itching to join them, but she held herself back. Mason showed no such restraint. He was out of his seat in no time, front and center, jumping in circles and running into people's legs. The younger people moved aside when the Papago women moved out from the wall and began to do the traditional 6-step dance. They moved in a loose line, slightly bent over, shuffling over the gravel and sounding, if not looking, exactly like the scratching hands that give the music its name. The place was packed. It took forever to get served, and there were some mixed-up orders, and nobody cared. The music was so buoyant. One of the Altea sisters actually cracked a smile. After 45 minutes, the bass player plucked his lit cigarette from the bridge of his guitar, and the Alvaros took a break. Emelina told me she and JT had come here on their first date. They were 14. Viola had come, too, but fortunately she spent the whole time in the kitchen advising Doña Altea on the menudo, which was Viola's specialty. JT was thus able to eat his whole meal with one hand on Emelina's knee under the table. "Just think," I said,
If you'd come on another night, the soup of the day would have been something else, and you and JT might never have gotten married. She smiled an odd little smile. I don't think there's anybody else in this town I could have married but JT. It was like we had each other's names printed on us when we were born. Seems like there's a lot of that in this town, I said. Oh, yeah, and people do what their parents did. The father's a hoghead, the son's a hoghead. I smiled. What's a hoghead? Locomotive engineer. I don't know why they call him that. She pecked her fingertips on the tabletop, watching the Papago women talking to the musicians. For a while, I'd believed that Emelina and JT, with their congenial partnership and all those miles between them, were like Carlo and me, parallel lines that never quite touched. I was wrong. Two nights before, when JT came home at 3 a.m., they made love in the moonlit courtyard, urgently, with some of their clothes on. My house was dark, but I was awake, invisible, in my kitchen. I felt abandoned. Emelina was nothing like me. It's dangerous, she said suddenly. Shit, you can't think about it, but it's hell, the railroad. Did you know Fenton Lee in high school? Sure. He was in a head-on wreck 2 years ago, bringing his train out of the yard in El Paso at night, and somebody else was coming in, lined for the same track. Nobody knows why. Maybe a signal failed. Southern Pacific says no, but JT says it happens. So Fenton was killed? I remembered him plainly, in horn-rimmed glasses. He had blonde bangs and a loud laugh. Yeah, it was real bad. They heard the crash all over the yard. The one engine climbed up the other one and sheared off the top. There wasn't a whole lot left. I felt numb. A train wreck and Fenton dead in it were beyond what I was willing to imagine. You can jump off when you see that coming, Emelina told me. Fenton's brakeman and conductor jumped off, and the other crew did, but Fenton stayed on. I guess he didn't really believe it. I told JT, if you ever see a headlight coming at you, don't you dare save the train. You get your butt out of there. The band started up again, and Emelina's mood quickly lifted. Our food arrived, and Mason snapped back to the table. Emelina resettled the baby in the rickety high chair. So you're going up to the res with Lloyd tomorrow, she said, her eyes twinkling. This is getting serious. If I was your mother, I'd tell you to wear garlic around your neck. She dipped the tip of her spoon into her refried beans and fed it to the baby. He took the spicy brown mush like manna from heaven. But since I'm not your mother, she said soberly, I'd advise you to wear nice-looking underwear. She embarrassed me. It's nothing serious, I said. We're not exactly couple material, are we? Me and Lloyd with one L. She looked up, surprised. He can't help how his name's spelled. She paused a minute, studying me. What, you think Lloyd's dumb? Now I had embarrassed myself. No, I don't think that. I just can't see myself with a guy that's into cockfighting. I'm sure Emelina suspected this was nowhere near the whole truth. She was thinking, I did hold Lloyd's misspelled name against him, and a lot of other things. That I couldn't see myself with a roughneck Apache hoghead who was her husband's best friend. I felt myself blush. I was just like Doc Homer, raising himself and Hallie and me up to be untouched by grace. I'll tell you something, honey, Emelina said, pausing her spoon midway en route to the baby's open mouth. Half the women in this town, and not just the single ones, would give up Sunday breakfast to go to White River in that little red truck. I know that, I said, paying attention to my enchiladas. I didn't know how to apologize to Emelina without owning up to something I wasn't sure I felt. Strictly speaking, I didn't think I was better than Lloyd and half the women in Grace. I was amazed, in fact, by Lloyd's interest in me. I also didn't think it would last very long. Emelina directed her energies back to mothering. Mason, honey, don't pull all that stuff out with your fingers, she shouted affectionately above the music, which had risen in pitch. I know it's stringy. I'll cut it up for you. She reached across the table, expertly dissecting Mason's chicken burro. For some reason, I glanced up at the baby, whose eyes and mouth were wide.
Something was severely wrong. He wasn't breathing. I knocked over my chair, getting to him. I reached my finger into his throat and felt something, but couldn't dislodge it. He made a voiceless gag. I stood behind his chair and pulled him up by the armpits, folded him over my left arm, and gave him four quick whacks between the shoulder blades. Then I rolled him over so he was face up and wide-eyed but still head down. Supporting his head with my right hand, I tucked two fingertips under his breastbone and poked hard. A small, hard, whole pinto bean shot out of his mouth like a bullet. The whole operation took maybe 30 seconds. Emelina picked the bean up off the table and looked at me. Her face was ashen as the baby's. "He was choking," I said dumbly, laying him carefully on the table. "That's the only way you can get something out of the windpipe when it's in that far." He lay still for about half a minute, breathing but still looking gray, and then he coughed twice and began to scream. His face turned rosy purple. Several women from nearby tables had whipped the napkins off their laps and were crowding in close around us. The music stopped. Emelina stared at her son like he was something she hadn't ordered, set down on the table. "It's okay to pick him up," I said. "He'll be sore in the ribs, but he's okay." She held him against her shoulder. He was still shrieking, and I don't think there was a person in the restaurant now who wasn't staring at us. At me, actually. Emelina looked up with enormous eyes, as if I were one of the saints in the wall, Our Lady of Blocked Windpipes. She wiped tears off her chin with the back of her hand. "It's no big deal," I said. It really wasn't. I had just done what I knew how to do. Emelina begged me to sleep in the house with them that night in case he stopped breathing again. There was no reason in the world for that to happen, and I told her so, but she was quietly beside herself. JT had left for El Paso that morning, for 2 weeks this time because of some mess about the derailment. Viola was out late at another so-called emergency meeting of her women's club. I think Emelina felt lonely or vulnerable, afraid of the simple fact that life held possibilities she couldn't handle alone. It must have been a rare experience for Emelina, and I felt for her. While we were making up a bed for me in the baby's room, I stopped and hugged her. She held on to me like a child. I knew better than to expect sleep. I lay curled on my side, listening in spite of myself to the baby's soft, exhaled breaths, and I kept turning my mind away from the one thought that kept coming back to me, persistent as an unwanted lover's hand, that I'd saved a life. I thought about Lloyd instead. I knew nothing about where we were going tomorrow. I hadn't seen that country. My mind turned over various expectations, none of which I recognized as my own. Who did I think I was, and what did I want from an Apache cockfighter with a misspelled name? His body, yes, but I couldn't take that risk and end up needing more. At some time in my life, I'd honestly hoped love would rescue me from the cold, drafty castle I lived in. But at another point, much earlier, I think, I'd quietly begun to hope for nothing at all in the way of love, so as not to be disappointed. It works. It gets to be a habit. A pack of coyotes set up a sudden racket near the house, yipping and howling. So close by, they sounded like they had us surrounded. When a hunting pack corners a rabbit, they go into a blood frenzy, making human-sounding screams. The baby sighed and stirred in his crib. At 7 months, he was just the size of a big jackrabbit, the same amount of meat. The back of my scalp and neck prickled. It's an involuntary muscle contraction that causes that, setting the hair follicles on edge. If we had manes, they would bristle exactly like a growling dog's. We're animals. We're born like every other mammal, and we live our whole lives around disguised animal thoughts. There's no sense pretending. Tomorrow, I thought, or the next day, or the day after that, I would have sex with Lloyd Peregrina. Chapter 12 Animal Dreams. On Sunday morning, I put on jeans, changed into a denim dress, then back into jeans again, feeling stupid. I can get into a mood where I annoy myself no end. At the moment when I got completely